This presentation is brought to you by iawaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Things I want to do today. The one is I want to just deal a little further with that difficult thing that we had at the end of last week, where God responds to the fact that that Rachel is the loved one by opening Leah's womb and giving her children, and Rachel remains barren for a much longer time. That's in chapter 29, around verse 31, 32. Where the Torah says, Vayar Hashem kisnua Leah, and Hashem saw that Leah was hated. And we had two approaches as to what that meant. The predominant approach among the Mefarshim is that it wasn't that Leah was hated, but the fact that Rachel was preferred made Leah feel hated. Of course, Yaakov loved them both, and we see that many times. That the fact that Rachel was always the preferred one made Leah feel hated. And the other view, that there was something about Leah that Yaakov hated, and that was the fact that she deceived him, and that for that he was willing to divorce her. And God then quickly allowed her to fall pregnant, and then he saw these children, and the Ramban brings the Medrash, and says, V'kivan shefakdoa kodesh baruch hu'bevonim, once she had children, Omar, he said, Yaakov said, Le'iman shel elo ani megarish, am I going to divorce the mother of these children? I don't think the sense is that he looked at these children and thought, poor babies, what will I do with these? How can I do this to their mother? I think that he looked at them as the future of the Jewish nation, and saw that God had brought things about in a way where she was the first mother, the first matriarch. So what is he going to do? Is the patriarch going to divorce the matriarch? And obviously God had designed it so that she was going to be the mother of these children, and he realized that this wasn't the appropriate thing to do. So we have those two views. The one is that there was something about her that Yaakov actually despised, and the other was that he loved her greatly, but not as much as Rachel. And they're probably both those views are correct. And Vayiftach es Rachmon, God opened her womb, V'Rachel akoro, and Rachel was barren. And then we start the whole period of the births of the first generation of the Jewish nation. And the first one is Vatah, Leah has a child. She calls him Reuven. Reuven means see, a son. Ki Omro, because she said, Ki Ro'o Hashem Be'oni, God has seen my suffering. Ki Ato Yehevani Ishi, now perhaps my husband will love me. The next one is Shimon. Why Shimon? Shama means here. She says, Ki Shoma Hashem Ki Snua Anochi, because God has heard that I am hated. Vayitin li gamezeh, and so he has given me also this one. So a second son. She has a third son, and she calls him Levi. Levi means a company. And she says, Ato hapom yelove ishi elai, now my husband will accompany me. And the various different approaches. The one Rashi brings is that she knew there were four wives. There was Rachel and Leah, and each of them, there was Bilhah and Zilpah, each had that maidservant who also became a wife of Yaakov. So the assumption was that each would have three children. Levi is her third child. So she says, now I've done my bit, I'm secure, so to say. And the other view is that she had two children that she could handle. The third child becomes a burden for a woman if they're tightly spaced. You can carry one child on each arm. Who carries the third child? So she said, well, now my husband is going to have to help me. Which is quite a pathetic statement of their relationship. That means she thought, well, now at least there will be some form of companionship. We will be brought together by this third child. And then the fourth one was Yehuda, where she thanks God for giving me more than my share. I've had three children. That's what everybody expected, that each one would have three. But I've got four now. That means I've got a third rather than a quarter of the number of sons that are going to be born. And then Rachel and Yaakov get into an interesting interaction, which we might not get to today. And we raised last week, what is this that God responds to Leah in that way? Why does Rachel have to suffer because Yaakov loves her? What is that? One of the people who deals with it is Simcha Zichel Ziv. Simcha Zichel was one of the three Talmidim, one of the three disciples of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Yisrael Salanter is a very important moment in recent Torah history. Firstly, he was the founder of what has become known as the Musa movement, although it wasn't a movement at all. It was consisted of him and three disciples. But he did start a whole process of learning Musa, which was an interesting parallel in the Torah world to Freud in the secular world, where he acknowledged that intellectualizing Torah will not change people anymore. It used to change people, and it might change the great people who are able, through the intellectualizing, to enter a different world of being that actually impacts on them. But if one isn't that degree of an intellectual, that one's ideas impact on who one is, and most people are not that. We know from history that there have been people who had magnificent ideas who've been terrible people. So he began to get worried that ideas alone will no longer have the capacity to change people, and introduced Musa as a way of learning that was highly emotive, so as to work directly on the feelings of people rather than on the cold intellect of the people. That was one of Rabbi Yisrael's important innovations. Also his emphasis on character development, that he felt one couldn't just assume that because somebody was studying in yeshiva that his character would develop, that there had to be conscious work, and he designed processes and plans and methodology to change people, to grow people, to develop people's character. That was all Rabbi Yisrael, and it was very controversial. There were a lot of people that didn't like it at all at that time. He was a direct lineage in terms of scholarship, not in terms of blood lineage, from the Vilna Gaon, because his teacher was Rabbi Zundel Salant, and Rabbi Zundel Salant's teacher was Rabbi Chaim Volozhiner, who was the founder of the modern yeshiva concept. And Rabbi Chaim Volozhiner was the Talmud, was the disciple of the Vilna Gaon. So he's very, very important. He had three disciples. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter had three disciples, of whom Rabbi Simcha Zichel, the one I'm quoting to you now, is one, and in a way the toughest one. Rabbi Simcha Zichel was very much a purist, and he lived in a town called Kelem, not Chelm, but Kelem. Kelem was a little village in Lithuania that was, it was a gem of a community. Some of the stories that I've heard from people who've lived in Kelm, I think I've even mentioned some of them to you. The arguments that the rabbis used to deal with, the kind of argument, a typical arbitration in Kelm would be where the one party says, when I sold my property to this person, the market was at a certain level. When he took delivery, the market had come down, so I'm insisting he pays me the lower price. And the other one would say, I absolutely refuse. When we made the deal, the market was high, and I agreed to buy it at that deal. I insist on paying the higher price. Those were the court cases they used to have in Kelm. The rabbis never had to deal with the take issues. It was always, I'm not willing to accept. And the other person saying, that you've got to accept. And a rabbi having to decide whether he has to accept or not. Amazing. Just unbelievable, just the quality of people in that town. And there was a place called the Kelma Talmud Torah. They didn't even call it a yeshiva. Nowadays they call, if a 12-year-old girl goes on a one-year program in Israel, they call it yeshiva. In those days, the Kelma Talmud Torah, they didn't call it a yeshiva, because they felt yeshiva is something even greater. But the Kelma Talmud Torah must have had about 30 students in it. Each student was... there's nobody as great today as one of the ordinary students of the Kelma Talmud Torah. These were the giants. But giants not only in learning, giants in character and in nobility as well. This was known, this was a place that just produced diamonds. It was an unbelievable place. And Rabbi Simcha Zichel was the head of the Kelma Talmud Torah. He founded it and ran that. That was the place where if your shoes weren't sparkling, shining when you walked in, you were fired, you were asked to leave. That was considered not dignified, not respectful to come into a place like that. Bear in mind that that was a place that, where the streets weren't tarred. There were no pavements. So you can imagine what walking in the winter was, and you couldn't come into the Beis HaMikdash with a speckle on your shoe. People often tell the story about coming in with dirty shoes, but they don't realize what effort it must have taken to make sure that when they walked inside, their shoes were sparkling, that when you walked into the Kelma Tometer, everybody looked just dressed meticulously. And the behavior and the conduct and everything was just something apparently very, very amazing. And Reb Elia Lopian, my father's uncle, was there and in fact took over from Reb Simcha Zissel at a later stage. Reb Simcha Zissel had a lot to do with forming his personality. So Reb Simcha Zissel was the beginning of the century, around that, the early part of the century. He refers, to try and understand this, and I'm warning you that it's not an easy thing to understand, he refers us to a story that Tosfos brings in Chagigah about a very tragic Talmudic personality by the name of Rabbi Elisha ben Abuya. Elisha, the son of Abuya. He was the Rebbe of Rabbi Meir. Elisha ben Abuya was a man who was a teacher of Rabbi Meir. To give you an idea of what happened to him, Maaseh ba'Acher, they used to call him Acher, was his name. Acher, another man they used to call him Acher. Shayorochev al hasus b'Shabbos, he was riding his horse on Shabbos, which is about as serious in that time in those societies as driving your car on Shabbos. So one Shabbos, Rabbi Elisha ben Abuya was driving. Rabbi Meir mahalech acharav lilmud Torah, and Rabbi Meir, imagine the spectacle. Rabbi Meir was walking alongside the car and learning Torah from Rabbi Elisha ben Abuya as he was teaching. Just imagine the spectacle. Rabbi Elisha ben Abuya, imagine this picture, riding the car with his window rolled down, teaching Rabbi Meir who's walking alongside. Amar loy Meir chazor la'acharecha shekvar shi'arti be'ikveh hasus ad kan tchum Shabbos. At a certain point he said to Rabbi Meir, he said, Meir, you've got to go back now. He said, I've been counting the horse's steps, and I realize that we've come to the Tchum. You're not allowed to walk more than 2,000 cubits outside of a town on Shabbos. So you've got to turn back. So while he was riding and talking, he was counting so that he would know what the point was at which Rabbi Meir could no longer continue. Amalei afata chazor b'asa. Rabbi Meir says, you're also Jewish, you know. So why don't you turn around as well? But atach hazorbach also implies do tshuva. You also return. In other words, come, my teacher, it's time for both of us to return. Let us return. Get off your horse and walk back. And amalei v'lo kvar amati lo, so he answered, did I not already tell you? Kvar shemati ma'achorei haparagud. I have heard from heaven, he's had a direct line, shuvu vonim shovavim. All of you mischievous children, return. Chutz me'acher, with the exception of Acher, I won't accept his children. So he was a great man who then left Jewish practice, retained his wisdom. Rabbi Meir continued studying from him even after he did, and never came back properly again. How did all that happen? Where did all that start from? This is a fascinating. There's actually a book written about him. Do you know the book? As a Driven Leaf, that's the one. As a Driven Leaf. He was standing watching somebody perform the mitzvah of chasing away the mother bird and taking the egg. And it says with that particular mitzvah, when you do that mitzvah, if you want the egg and you chase the mother bird away, you don't just take the egg away from the mother, God will lengthen your days. And as this person was performing the mitzvah, the ladder fell and he died. And he said to him, yes, there was, you're right, it was Kibbutz Avayim as well. There was honoring the parents as well, which is the other mitzvah. The two mitzvahs about it, which it says, I will lengthen your days, are honoring your parents and Shiluach HaKen. And this child was doing both those mitzvahs. And as he did them, he died. And Rabbi Elisha ben Abuya, the integrity of the man, said, I can't live without dilemma. So he had a faith crisis, but he had an unbelievable integrity. He just couldn't live, and he gave up his Judaism. He didn't give up his learning, but he gave up his Jewish practice. But the Tosfos brings here the the tradition that goes back to the very origin of Rabbi Elisha ben Abuya, and this is what Rav Simcha Zissel quotes. And Tosfos says the following. Avuya, Avi, this is now the story. Elisha is telling the story about his father, Avuya. My father, Avuya. Hava Migdoila Yerushalayim was one of the great people of Jerusalem. Imagine in that society who this Avuya was. Uvayom Shebo Lemahuli, Koro Lechol Gedola Yerushalayim, and the day of my bris, he invited all the elders of Jerusalem. So imagine who was at the bris of Elisha. Rishivan Bevayis Echod. And he put them in one part of the building. And Rabbi Elozan and Rabbi Yeshua, two of the great people of the time, were sitting in another place. This celebration started, there was eating, there was drinking, there was singing, there was dancing. Amri, Rabbi Elozan and Rabbi Yeshua said to one another, Ad alayn askin bididhu nasot bididan. They're enjoying themselves. Everybody here seems to be enjoying themselves with their singing and dancing and eating. Let us do what we most enjoy. Yoshua and Isaskar B'divrei Torah, they sat down to study Torah. To us, we get much more pleasure from that and celebration from that than from the singing and dancing. Yordo Esh Min Hashemayim V'Hikifo Ison, a fire came down from heaven and surrounded them. Omar Lon Avuya, so Avuya, Avuya, my father, this is Elisha's story, so he came up to them and said, Gavri, mo batim lisrom lisrof beisi, if you come to burn down my house. He was astonished, he saw this fire around them, and he was scared. He said, what are you doing? Avrullah chasvashor, he said, no, not at all. Ela yoshvin hayinu v'chozin divrei Torah. We were busy going over our Torah. Mitorah l'neviim, we went into the prophets, and l'neviim l'ksuvim, we went into the later prophets. And we got to a point where we enjoyed the truth and the accuracy of those words as much as they did at Sinai. We were able to penetrate the essence to the point that there was the same clarity as there was when God gave this at Sinai. Wasn't it given with fire? When you get to that level of clarity, there's such an energy that it can actually translate into fire. So we didn't cause it, we were just learning. Sorry, we didn't plan to burn your house down at all. Omar, he said, I've never seen the power of Torah to that degree, that Torah can actually develop energy that's visible.
The father said that.
The father said, if this child lives, I will dedicate him to Torah. And because his intention was not pure, that's why it didn't last. An unbelievable thing. He was dedicating his child to Torah, not because of the truth of Torah, but because of the honor, the power, the there was something in it. He was moved not by the Torah, but by the spectacle, and that spectacle and the honor of it is what attracted him. Again, we're talking about great people. These are not things that we would be held accountable to anywhere near that level. But Rav Simcha Zissel brings this as an example of how the desire for honor and recognition as a motivation damages the purity of the outcome. The honor and recognition is a consequence. You do something which is great, and you do it because it's great, and there's honor and recognition. Well, there's honor and recognition, but choosing your actions on the basis of what honor and recognition they generate damages the outcome. And he brings a lot of material showing how negative and destructive the force of seeking honor is in the purity of what one does. And not just the seeking of honor, he goes further and says even the getting of honor is dangerous. Because it tends to taint and it tends to affect the way one thinks and operates, and then that becomes part of the deal. He claims that Rochel had, or that the Torah indicates an unreasonable focus of honor on Rochel at the expense of Leah. Now, let's just try and understand that a little bit more clearly, because we know that Rachel gave Leah the signs, and if she didn't, Leah wouldn't have been anywhere. So she had an interest, she had a concern for Leah. The sign that she gave Leah saved Leah an enormous amount of embarrassment at the wedding that we established last week. But sometimes we do something for a person and we don't see it all the way through. So she saved her that hardship. And what did she do? She launched her into a life of hardship. If you're so concerned about Leah, then take care of her dignity thereafter. Because once Yaakov decides to marry Rachel as well, now Leah's once again in jeopardy. So the first time that Leah's in jeopardy is at the wedding. And Rachel says, I've got to give her the signs. This is what Yaakov would want me to do, even that means I will never marry Yaakov. She does that. Yaakov then finds a way to marry Rachel as well. At that point, the Torah seems to have expected of Rachel a continued concern of the lack of dignity that Leah would be experiencing by the continuous focus on Rachel. And we see no evidence of her taking care of that at all. And on the contrary, we see ongoing suffering on the part of Leah. We see it in the naming of the first two children. What does she say? The first child she names Reuven, and she says, Ki ro'o Hashem bo'ni, God can see my suffering. What does that mean? It doesn't say because God knows my suffering. God can see my suffering. What does that mean? It's visible. The next one, Ki shomo Hashem ki snu anochi, God hears that I am despised. Where did he hear from? That must be from the way Yaakov speaks to her. That there's something to hear that is undignified for her. And the third one, of course, is Levin. Now he will accompany me, which means at that time she wasn't accompanied. So she was completely abandoned and rejected, or felt completely abandoned and rejected in that relationship. And to some degree, on the level they were operating, remember, these are the founders of the Jewish nation, so the slightest little fracture in their character is treated very seriously, because you're dealing with a foundation, you're not dealing with some little aesthetic problem on the 150th floor of the building. You're dealing with a fracture in the foundation of the Jewish people. The Torah sees, God sees a fracture in Rachel's capacity to be sensitive to the inevitable hurt. She's not going to be able to remove the hurt of Leah, but we see no effort to in any way address it and try and minimize it to whatever degree she can, to the point where Leah feels the only person who can help me is God, and God does help her. And that's the way that Simchas Ishul deals with it. Is it satisfying? No, it's not satisfying, yes, but it introduces some sense of what Rachel did wrong, because we look at the heroism of Rachel in the first action, and we tend, once a person has become a hero, to excuse them of everything else and say, but look what they did. Yes, that was the beginning of something, but that needed to be continued throughout their lifetime. And it seems that Rachel didn't. Rachel felt, I've done my thing, I gave her the signs, I don't owe her any more than that. And God's saying, no, that's not right. If you cared about her, then see that caring all the way through to minimize her suffering in this relationship. And Rachel is to some degree held responsible, and Leah is compensated for with the children. Some kind of interest that's going on the table.
I was just wondering, I mean, Leah was crying the whole time before she ever got married about... She's crying, crying, crying. I think it's when she's crying, crying, crying again. And it's like, I'm wondering if, was she some kind of, I'm wondering if there was something wrong with her. That she just like was always, like...
We see no evidence of that. We see that her crying in both cases was justified. That she wasn't crying out of depressiveness, she was crying out of something that could be done something about. She was crying to pray to God not to let her land up in Leah. She didn't just cry and do nothing. She used all her forces to appeal to God. In this case too, as we're going to see in the next episode, she does, she acts, she tries her best to attract Yaakov and to be there for Yaakov. She does her best. She does whatever she can, but there are forces in Leah's life that are always beyond her control. There are external forces that create difficulties for her. That make her quite a pathetic, a sad figure. Yeah?
But if Yaakov loved Rachel more, what could Rachel have really done?
Just protected her a little bit more, honored her more, spoken to her in a way that explained, that encouraged Yaakov to take care of her a little bit more. A little bit more of that, I guess. Couldn't have saved it, couldn't have changed that. But just to make Leah feel a little, there seems to just be no, and by the fact that she is punished in this way, confirms that there was no effort on Rachel's part to in any way minimize that suffering. Here's the next question. Linda.
Yes. Father Lee lacks this too. It seems like Yaakov, I'm wondering if there's absence when you say that embarrassing somebody is a felony murder. And they were plotting this marriage for 7 years. It never occurred to them that it would be the equivalent of murder. And it never occurred to Yaakov all the way along that it was the equivalent of murder. And now, again, if Rachel wasn't quite acting right, but it was really Yaakov's affection that he wanted, he seems to be completely passive and not in any way culpable. So, as two questions, why is Yaakov kind of off the hook? And how is it that these two very great people didn't realize that what they were going to do was the equivalent of murder until the last minute? And then continue to do it.
That part of the question is less serious, because what was the embarrassing part? That they would get, that she would get married before Leah?
The embarrassing part was that Susan was rejected at the wedding.
Because they could foresee that they did foresee, in fact,
they
we know.
They foresaw at the last minute. Right?
And why did they not deal with that? Two very strong questions. I want to think about them. Two very strong questions. And why does Yaakov get off the hook? Or does Yaakov get off the hook? If Yaakov is the one that is the heroine, should be Rachel. You're saying the heroine should be Rachel, and she's the one who comes off harsh.
And you know, up until the point of the wedding, but then after the wedding, I mean, he's the husband, he's the one who has to treat her right.
This man also because Yaakov does have him in a way, because his children don't come from a woman that he really loves. So while he does have lots of children, they come from a woman that he would have been much happier if the woman's
yeah, and of course Rachel dies and he suffers terribly with that. He doesn't have much time with Rachel. His time with Rachel is short and troublesome. And then he goes through the whole thing with Yosef. And Yaakov has a terrible life.
He has a very hard life, but is that those difficulties tie? I mean, the barrenness is tied very clearly to the way of the situation.
It does. I'll tell you where we see it, in fact, is because what Chazal do say is part of the reason that he suffered so with Yosef is because he favored Yosef. Why did he favor Yosef? Because she came from Rachel. And all that suffering of the 20 years with Yosef, thinking with Yosef, all of that was an asa. So there is, Yaakov does suffer. But in this part of it, one would think that there would be something more direct. And I want to think about that a little bit, that Rachel seems to be getting a very tough deal. When she's the only one who's actually acted properly.
And immediate.
So I want to think that through a little bit.
Other things that if one person is 100% responsible, it doesn't mean another person is more
responsible.
Right. So maybe they're holding Rachel
100%
and they're also holding Yaakov.
Yes, but in this episode, there's no direct, Yaakov, you're doing wrong in this area. It's almost consequent. As a result, it's not immediate. Yeah. As a result of this, you favor Yosef. As a result of that, all sorts of outcomes will come. And I think there's something in it that I want to think on. That's a powerful question. Let me just go around and help you. Well, we're still going to deal with Leah. There is a little bit, and we'll still see it. It's a bit early to see that relationship, but in the next piece that we're going to do, some of that does come up. Some of that relationship does come up. Anything on the side of the table, Judy?
When you were speaking earlier about Acher and the crisis of faith, and you said that it was a sign of integrity that he stopped Jewish practice. So that, to me, was very striking, and it would take us off the subject now, but at a future time, would you go into that more? Because what does that say about other people, maybe, who went through the Holocaust or other cataclysmic events in their life? And is it an issue of intellectual integrity to stop practice? Or is it a matter if you keep your faith? I was just very struck by that.
I think just very briefly, that you've got something to work on with it, is that intellectual integrity without faith leads to dishonesty. No, not dishonesty, leads to absence of truth. There's a difference between honesty and integrity and truth. Truth is universal. Honesty and integrity is individual, is personal. So a person can be faithful to himself, that is intellectually integrous. But if he's not faithful to a bigger truth, his own integrity can lead him off the truth. And that's why faith and integrity have to go together. if you have integrity without faith, you're excluding the part of reality that you can't see. And you're saying, I will be honest to everything I can see. Well, what you can see is just this room. So there is a stupidity in integrity that has no faith. There is stupidity in a faith that has no integrity. There's a dishonesty in a faith that has no integrity. So while I said it was the ultimate of integrity to do what he did, integrity without faith is a dangerous thing. Because yes, integrity without faith would lead people to give up Judaism after the Holocaust, and it makes you manipulate God. It basically says, God, do it in a way that I can understand, or I'm giving you up.
Right. I mean, it's an invitation to say that, you know, at whatever level of discomfort or even, you know, up to tragedy, that you can say, that's it, I'm walking away.
Yes, with intellectual integrity encourages you to do that. So while intellectual integrity is right, it needs to be expanded to include things that you don't always understand immediately. Otherwise, you're limiting your understanding to the things that you can experience immediately, and you're holding God to ransom. And you're saying, I'm honest, therefore, I will do what you can prove to me. And if you don't prove it right now, this minute, I will leave you. So leave you, so walk, go.
So Acher is not held up as...
a paragon of virtue, not at all.
Yeah, okay.
No. Right. I'm just saying that in seeing it, one has to realize the greatness. Why did Rabbi Meir carry on studying with him? Because Rabbi Meir recognized that the honesty was 100% there. The intellectual side of this man was absolutely in place. That Rabbi Meir realized, that there was no blemish on his ability to think. The problem was in his area of faith. So Rabbi Meir said, I don't have to learn faith from Acher. I don't need to learn faith from Acher. But the intellectual process and the integrity process, that he continued to learn from Acher.
I don't know if that book was completely true, but I mean, Elisha went on to spend
the end of his life, he tries to come back. I don't know if that came out in the book, and he has this situation where he believes he can't. He believes he's having given up faith, deprives him of the opportunity of truly coming back, because at the end it's faith which would bring him back. Rationally, he doesn't have an answer. So what would bring him back is faith, and he didn't have the faith. So faith and integrity are two things that have to go hand in hand. Unfortunately, usually they don't. So you get people with a lot of integrity who have no faith, and that limits what they're prepared to accept to what can be proved to them. And you have people with a whole lot of faith who have no integrity, in which case they can do what they want. They're in a different area of freedom. And it's being able to merge those two and find the integrity within faith and faith within the integrity, that is part of the tension that creates
terror Judaism. I didn't get how that linked up to the discussion of Rachel and Leah today.
The impact of honor, that where there is a seeking of honor or an experiencing of honor, it tends to distort the purity of the action.
Mm-hmm.
And that Rachel basked in the honor of being
the loved
one, and that distorted things, that damaged that whole constellation. And that's what God was bringing back into line by her being the barren one. He was assisting her. Maybe that will help answer your question, Linda, that part of this was not a punishment. Part of this was saying, if you can't do it yourself, I'm going to have to help you be modest. You're spoiling the whole structure by the honor that you're enjoying in that relationship. And by coming down a peg and noticing that you're not the mother of the children, will give you a few years to get that relationship right and to realize that Leah is somebody special too. That one might have to see it less as a punishment and more as a balancing, as bringing or assisting Rachel to deal with her own humility. In a situation where it wasn't easy to be humble, she was constantly being elevated, and she needed something to bring her back to scale, and that's what God gave her.
In Asher's case, his father was the one that wanted the honor, wasn't it?
Yes.
So why did that totally
stop
him?
Because there, the part of it that I didn't do with you is the Gemara uses that to explain the concept of that when something is initiated with a flaw, the flaw perpetuates. If a flaw is introduced at a later stage, then you can treat the flaw. But when at the initiation there's a flaw, it affects the whole process. And at the birth of Acher, there was a flaw in his being directed to Torah, and that impacted on him. And obviously that would play a part in the way God judges him, because what you're saying is part of it wasn't his, although there was choice on his part, but that flaw was something that he didn't put into place. The flaw was something that his father put into place. The second point we'll have to deal with next week, and the second point gets on to it touches two interesting things, attaches a certain forwardness in Leah that we're going to deal with, and the living out of that forwardness in Dino's being held responsible to some degree for her rape. And although that part is much further, the two are linked, and in order to understand this section, we're going to have a look at that one as well, so we'll do that.